beautiful people, you are now listening to season 3 of the Platinum Rule podcast. Our priority is to give our listeners the most recent information about current events, public policy, activism, and much, much more.
Hello, hello. Welcome back to the Platinum Rule. This is Sophia.
And I am Amari, and we are so happy to be back with you all.
Glad only 1 week break happened this time. We're back. We're ready. Tell the people what you're up to.
Well, Sophie and I were kind of chatting earlier, or like actually a couple minutes ago, and we were like, let's just press record. So record is pressed, and I'm actually packing for New York, you guys. I'm going to New York for my first time ever tomorrow. So
fun. This is summertime.
This is going to be a really big deal, especially because, I mean, it doesn't really affect New York, but since California is fully open now, which we'll get into in a couple minutes, and it's Juneteenth on Saturday, so I think I'm going to go to Brooklyn and just, like, experience the culture and go to, like, a day fest with my people.
Oh, I'm so excited. I want all the pics. Send me all the snaps.
Oh, I feel like I'm realizing that I've been halting my, like, fashion forwardness in Sacramento just because it's been the pandemic and I haven't gone anywhere basically since I've lived here. So now I'm like, okay, I'm taking fit pics every day.
Absolutely.
I'm back to who I am. So what's going on with you? Any updates for the group?
I'm just hanging around, having fun till I start my new job in July. So we're just, just so much to do. California's reopening.
Do you feel like sharing with the listeners where you're moving to, where you are at, and where you're moving to in case anyone forgot?
Yes. So I am in Orange County right now, just moved here last August. I am headed back to the Bay Area. Couldn't stay away for too long.
Yeah, area.
Not gonna lie, SoCal has definitely earned its place in my heart. Very special place for everybody here, but I gotta go back home, y'all.
Exactly, and maybe you guys will see some developments between the two of us very, very soon. Let's get into the meat of the episode. But before, we kind of want to make a little statement about love, y'all.
We wanted to take a moment for Pride Month to let our friends listening know that we are here to uplift, support, and celebrate the LGBTQ loved ones in our lives today and every day, but this month especially. It's a big deal to be your authentic self anywhere. Here's to all the years of being who you are, flawlessly and unapologetically. Though the LGBTQ identity is cause for all the celebration, it also comes with challenges. Folks don't always feel they can bring their authentic self and relationships to all aspects of their lives. This includes home, church, work, school, and even institutions like healthcare. We here at the Platinum Rule want to let you guys know we're in this with you. So much love for all of you. Happy Pride Month, y'all. I hope you've got some celebrating in.
That is, you guys can't hear it, but full snaps on my side. Beautiful messaging. We just want to acknowledge that we fully support everyone, and especially those in the LGBTQIA community. We love you all forever and always. All right, moving on. So California has officially reopened. Sophia, how do you feel about this moment right now? This is history in the making.
We've been waiting. I'm outside. You know where I'm at. Yeah, it feels like I feel very lucky that to be in the United States, especially California, where we are reopening. I feel safe doing it in the process. I know some of my friends, my roommate actually just headed to work, and I'm like, are you going to wear your mask at the restaurant? And she's like, I am. Some people are a little scared, you know, which I don't blame them. So it will be interesting to see how it's going to all roll out. I know I have another friend at Twitter today in San Francisco, got to go into her office today. It's just, it feels like the first day of school, kind of. Mm-hmm. It's kind of crazy.
100%. So just to kind of give you guys a couple bits of information. So what does reopening mean? Reopening means that there are no capacity limits or distancing requirements by the state of California. Now, if there's a private business that requires you to distance and have capacity limits, obviously you oblige by their rules. And if you are vaccinated, masks are no longer required indoor, outdoor, anywhere. But if you are not vaccinated, you still gotta wear your mask. Sorry, friend. And last but not least, there are no colored tier systems by county. They're out. We're done with that. No one's green. No one's blue. No one's purple. It's a go. Mm-hmm. Even though that was pretty much a headliner. But moving on to a little bit more of a headline. It's going to cost $215 million to conduct the recall election, Sophia. And you have paid into that because you're a taxpaying citizen. I have paid into that because I'm a taxpaying citizen. How do you feel about your taxpayer money being spent on a $215 million recall?
At what cost are we, like, what's coming from this? I'm confused.
And then to, like, not just wait 8 more months.
When's this guy's term over?
The election would literally be next November.
November 21 or 22?
22. Like, his term would traditionally end after the 2 years, so in 2022. So, it's like, what are we doing here, you guys? And, like, what's the point?
What is the point? I wonder if people that would want to recall Gavin Newsom think that more damage is to be done in the last year. Well, less than a year, I guess.
I feel like it's just a way, and not to call anyone out, but it's just a way for moderates and Republicans to feel like they can have a win. Although the likelihood of Gavin Newsom being recalled is slim to none. The only time this has ever happened was years ago, and it was like crazy, crazy close. And Gavin Newsom is nowhere near as bad as that candidate was at that time, especially when it comes to approval ratings, especially now because California's fully reopened. So all of their points aren't points anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We will be keeping you guys updated on recall info. If it does end up going through fruition, it will be happening this September 2021.
Woo, just won't quit.
Just won't quit. On to the next. Hallucinogenics. California. California legalizing hallucinogenics?
Question mark?
It might be an exclamation point, y'all, because it is on the docket. Sophia, I see you're very exuberant about this. Give me your thoughts. Rattle your thoughts.
Well, my first thought is criminal charges would probably
drop. It would be decriminalized and legalized. They're different.
And this is just for hallucinogenics.
Hallucinogenics. So mushrooms, ecstasy. Whoa. I think acid might be on the list.
Oh my goodness.
But I don't know anything about any of that. Mom, Dad, if you're listening, I don't know anything about any of that.
Right. I just think of the decriminalization aspect. My thoughts on it, I think people are going to do it regardless. I mean, I guess maybe it would be safer if it was in a more accessible way. We don't have to, not we, but people won't have to be sketchy in where they're getting these things supplied from.
100%.
But I don't know. I just think health and decriminalization. Do you have any thoughts on this specifically?
I'm all for it. I'm all for all the drugs, whatever makes living this existence easier for you. I say go for it, as long as you're not harming yourself or others around you.
Right. As always, we will keep you guys posted on that outcome. And also, we're going to clarify that list of hallucinogenics, just to be clear. What do we have up next?
Okay, so this is the part of the episode where I go on my spiel about either policy or important news factors that everyone should have a deeper understanding of. As some of you may know, California actually lost a congressional seat this year after the 2020 census was released. And before I continue, I would just like to say, I told y'all to fill out the census. Anyway, for the first time in 171 years, our population has actually decreased. The census population estimate is determined by birth rate, death rate, and migration, aka how many people have left and how many people have entered the state. We are by no means claiming that the state population is getting significantly smaller, but it's not growing as fast as the rest of the country. California has held 53 seats in the House of Representatives in Congress, which has been amazing, but with one less seat, that means we get one less electoral college vote, less money allocation from the federal government, and less overall representation. And lastly, our districts will be redrawn, and instead of 53 districts, it'll be down to 52. Sophia, do you have any thoughts on any of that?
I have many, many thoughts. In a previous episode, we did talk about packing into when district lines are redrawn. These lines don't have to follow certain patterns at all. So I want you guys to go back to that episode if you haven't given it a listen. It's very strategic in how these district lines are drawn.
I think that was our statehood and gerrymandering episode.
Yeah, I believe so. Statehood and gerrymandering. And also, we do have a graphic on it on our Instagram. Let me just plug our Instagram really quick. Platinum Rule Podcast. You know where to find us. But yeah, there's a graphic on there that kind of gives a little breakdown of that. So that's my first thought that comes to mind. Another thing is one less electoral college vote with the electoral college. I'm saying that so weird. Am I saying that funny?
It like tripped me up today too. Electoral.
Electoral
college. It's Mercury vote. Retrograde in Gemini, you guys. It messes up communication.
So I'm just, okay, so back to the main point. I'm a little tripped out about that. I definitely don't think California needs to lose one. We're a big state. We're pretty strong in our votes, but oh my gosh, that's one vote. How do we know we're not going to lose like five more or whatever? That's another thought. Another thought too is I was actually with the marketing agency that got hired on for the California Census 2020 project. And I'm wondering how it was handled during the pandemic year to have the census filled out. Because from a marketing standpoint, we were definitely working on the outreach, but I left the agency before I had the chance to even see any of those plans come to fruition. So part of me is a little concerned about how that was handled, mainly from a constituent point that now I've got one less electoral college vote and one less representation in Congress, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Because this is going to affect our Congress standing. I don't really like the sound of that. And lastly, my last thought on this is, why isn't this like raising alarms? Why isn't this a bigger headline to me? Honestly, Amari asked me to, when we were running through the episode notes, she had brought this up and I said, oh, leave it as just the headline. I want to hear what's going on with the matter as we record live. So this is my live reaction right now. And I'm wondering why I haven't heard about it prior to this. That's a little alarming in itself. And I hope it's kind of causing that for all of you too. Not from a scared standpoint, but like, woo, we need to be alert.
100%. And that's exactly why I wanted to have us discuss it on the podcast, because I'm pretty sure none of our listeners know this. They have not been talking about it. It is not news. This is something that I had to find, basically, because I have been so obsessed with the census, as you all know, something that I've been like keeping track of, because I've seen detrimental things happen when you lose something like a congressional seat, especially in smaller states. Thankfully, California is a huge conglomerate, so our stressors aren't as prominent, but it's still very, very important to know so we can do better in 2030. I have a conspiracy theory. Can I have a conspiracy theory on the pod? Is that like allowed? I'm telling you guys, it's a conspiracy theory. Don't take me seriously, but I think because Trump signed that executive order that was basically threatening immigrants from filling out the census and having so much disdain for people who are immigrants in this country, I think that we lost a lot of representation just because of that alone. A lot of right. people don't know this, and we shared this on the podcast. No matter what your
citizenship standing.
Thank you. No matter what your citizenship standing is, you can still fill out the census because it's a larger picture and it's the only data they're going to have for the next 10 years. So they have to have, whether it's legal or not, they have to have a good estimate of what's going on, especially state by state, especially when it comes to redrawing districts and, you know, funneling out money. It doesn't matter because whether or not they're, you know, federal legal status is approved, there's, you know, you're still here. You're still a human. You're still a part of the communities. You're still going to the schools. You're still accessing the healthcare system. You're still driving the roads. You're still, you know, possibly even paying taxes. So I feel like this is just a conspiracy. There is nothing at all claiming this. If I was a investigative journalist, I would start going ham and figuring this out and actually finding out if this is true. But I think that, you know, because California is a huge migrant state, a lot of the people who live here just simply were not counted. And because of COVID. A lot of people weren't thinking about the census because of COVID. And Trump purposefully did not extend the October 2020 deadline. I'm sorry, but because of something like this. But this is all conspiracy, you guys.
The agency I was with, it was specifically targeting the hard-to-count population. So these are the populations that didn't have technology in their homes, didn't even have Wi-Fi. They're in the very, very rural areas. They don't have information to even get this relayed to them of there's an extension, there's not an extension. You know, people will be coming by to see you. No, they have no way of getting this information. This is the most uneducated populations out there. Not the dumbest, but most uneducated. And that's due to a lack of resources. So part of the agency work was, you know, overcoming those challenges. And then also the language barriers that exist. And unfortunately, lots of these hard to count populations were part of immigrant populations. And like you said, you know, the census is based on the bigger picture, that is resources for those occupying the land. It kind of is just like the principal idea of allocating resources and asking for what you need. So it is such a downfall that that wasn't completed correctly in a pandemic year. And we're going to have to see the aftermath of that for the next 10, which is kind of discouraging, but
100%. And just closing thoughts. Like you were saying, language barriers, it's not just Hispanic immigrants. It's also East Asian immigrants.
Yeah.
People forget that there are so many other nationalities and races from all over the world that come to places like California for solace.
Yes, and topics like this funnel down from the national level to the state level, even down to the local level. So today we wanted to highlight how to get involved and really get educated about how to even start getting involved locally. So for today's episode, we have a former employee to the Office of the General Counsel, specifically in the National Resource and Environment Division. She also spent time with Harrison Institute for Public Law as a policy analyst, in addition to working as a law clerk with a select committee on the climate crisis, and currently partakes in the research and litigation processes at a law firm. We are so lucky to have you on today's episode. This is Call My Lawyer, Alexandra Vota.
She is absolutely amazing. So Alex, would you just like to introduce yourself to the listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. So as Mari said, I'm Alex. I'm originally grew up in Potomac, Maryland, which is a suburb right outside of DC in Maryland, which is not Baltimore. Frequently get asked that question. It's right by DC. No hate to Baltimore, but love Baltimore. It was just a different vibe. And then I went to Arizona State University, was where I met Amari, and I got my BS in conservation biology and ecology, which I absolutely loved that major. And then now I'm just finishing up my last year of law school at Georgetown in DC, moved back to the East Coast, and then I'll be graduating in, I think it's like 3 weeks. I'll start my full-time job in September, where I'll be working in Towson, Maryland.
Wow. Awesome. Well, an early congratulations, because you're basically done. And I guess when it comes to next steps, how does the bar work in Maryland? And like, what is the process of working versus obtaining your bar and then like practicing law?
So a lot of people don't know this. You can go to law school and never take the bar if you don't want to be an attorney, which like you're practicing law. So you can go into policy work, but like go to work on the Hill or do public policy work, all that kind of stuff. You don't need to take the bar ever, which would be really nice.
Ideal.
Yeah, but if you do want to practice law, you have to take the bar, and it's been kind of funky because of coronavirus. And so it's like pretty much like any standardized test, like you get study aids or you pay for like a study program, and then you prep for that and take it in July is when I'll be taking it. And Maryland is is one of the states that does a UBE, which is like a uniform bar exam. So you get to take the same bar exam that I think it's like 30-something states do this now.
Nice.
So you take the same bar exam that everyone else is taking, but then you take a little extra part that's just for Maryland. And then that way, if you want to move states, you can essentially get waived into that state's requirement or just take the extra state part instead of having to do a whole new test.
Right.
Which is because the bar is different for every single state, so.
Well, thank you for that breakdown. What got you interested in not only law, but policy and government?
I guess I can start by growing up in Potomac, like you're right in the suburbs of DC. So I would say probably half of my friends have parents who work for the government. And so you're just kind of already exposed to that part of life. Like, you already get exposed to politics and the government as a concept from an early age. And then also, I think I had a relatively unique background because my grandma, on my dad's side, Carmen Delgado Bota, was very politically active. She did lobbying for, like, women and children, particularly Latino women and children. She's from Puerto Rico. And actually, there was a documentary about the National Advisory Committee for Women, which was created by Jimmy Carter in 1978.
Wow.
My grandma was in that. Wow. Like, a letter that he wrote to her on my wall right here.
What? That is legendary.
Yeah, so she was a really cool lady. And so just growing up around her, like, you're just going to learn so much about politics and stuff like that. And my family's pretty politically active. So I always kind of put a foot in the door of that. And then went to school, and the 2016 election happened, and you couldn't help but know or talk about it, particularly at Arizona State, where you have a great combo of, I'll say, a diversity of views and a lot of people who like to engage in conversations. You might otherwise would have just left it alone. And I actually started a group on campus during that time, or maybe it was like a month after or so, the election, of like educating people on political issues, quote unquote, but giving them like information so they can make their own decision, because a lot of things are influenced by politics but aren't inherently political. Those are different concepts. So we tried to do like a tabling thing where every week we cover a controversial issue and give people like, here, we just want to give you the info, and like, we're happy to debate you on like what we think about this information, but like, just so you know from a reliable source, like, this is actually the fact, instead of relying on Reddit or like some random blog you read or something like Breitbart.
Yeah. Or even scarier, not thinking about it at all.
That as well. So that's kind of what, like, really got me started in, like, the politics and, like, really seeing involved in more than just the environment, which is what I started being passionate about. Always had an inkling that I wanted to go to law school in the back of my head. I had a job in undergrad doing the PASS survey, if no one's ever heard of it, which I had not. It's the Phoenix, Arizona Social Survey, and they do it every 4 or 5 years, and they measure people's happiness with the environment around them, including, do you think you have enough birds in your neighborhood? Do you have enough parks? How hot?
I've never even heard of that.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and it's like very easy digestible information. And so it really made clear to me the disparities in access to natural resources that low-income communities have, which are also often communities of color. And that really made me realize that I'm learning all of these cool things in my major about how to conserve nature and how to help the environment be healthier, but unless you have laws in place to enforce those aspects of or in techniques, like, you're not going to get anywhere, and you're going to end up with a society where you have very wealthy people having access to natural resources and mostly poor people having no access, and also health consequences because of that.
How has the field you've entered now altered your thinking or way of life, personal or career-wise?
I break it down in two ways. So personally, I think law school has been a very mentally and emotionally difficult experience. Like, I really enjoy learning. I'm usually a very positive, like, upbeat person. But I think career-wise, one of the things I really opened my eyes was how ingrained the disparities and like racism is in a lot of our laws, like even ones that seem very like nondescript or neutral can have a lot of overtone or undertones of racism, and just like truly understanding how it's all very interconnected. And like, I always had this relatively naive picture, like, one person can make a difference, like, you can come in, like, if you try really hard, you can change everything. And I don't mean to be a Debbie Downer, but there's so much work that needs to be done, and so many people who are content with the things that, the way that things are, whether it is that they just don't care to learn about the issues, or they know about the issues and don't care. I think that's been pretty eye-opening and relatively discouraging, but kind of finding the area of law that I like is local, and that's very, like, you can change that pretty impactfully with just having one or a couple people, and so that gives me a little bit more hope. You just got to figure out what it is that you have the emotional capacity to take on.
I'm glad you bring up emotional capacity too, because there is a stigma
that emotional factors are totally taken out of it and disregarded. Sometimes it's kind of the downfall of policy and lawmaking is that emotion isn't involved enough. And sometimes it is why there is such a disconnect to those communities that aren't being represented.
I'm glad you brought that up. I have been in so many arguments or discussions tend to take the approach of this is just an intellectually interesting conversation. It's not. Like, we are talking about real people's lives when you're talking about the law. Like, you have an impact on how people live. You need to have emotion when you're doing that, or you're not going to understand the full effect of what you're doing. And then also that emotion can be an advantage. You don't have to be cold and logical. You can be both emotional and warm and connect to people while still being logical, and that can actually help convince other people that you are right.
Like, who wants to live a life not being, you know, multifaceted? You could only be logical or you could only be emotional. That's not how being a human works. Why are you trying to take one of your survival instincts, like, why are you trying to detach it from yourself to be more credible to someone else who's also a human that also possesses both of those things?
Logic and law does not have to be divorced from emotions and empathy and caring about other people. But you do have to recognize you can only do so much and you can only take so much, so got to figure out what's a good balance so you can stay sane.
So next I wanted to ask, how important is law in relation to public policy?
Glad you asked that. I think, you know, there's like the very obvious connection that, you know, public policy revolves around politics and politicians who are involved with making the law. But I think there's a really important connection that a lot of people don't understand is that laws create the process through which you are able to affect public policy. And if you have a really crappy process in place, even if you have the best intentions, it's not going to work. And that's, I think, part of the issue with systemic racism. It's also the issue that people don't understand with when you're electing lawmakers. So you can have an executive order that sounds great, but if the executive order doesn't have any teeth behind it, it's not going to get anything done. Which is why you need actual laws to be put in place, not just executive orders. Good example is in Sunset Park, New York, there was this development going into this area called Industry City, and the neighborhood didn't want it. And New York has all of these great, like, climate change goals and all of these goals for, like, equitable development that they have at, like, a top level. But the way that the process is under the law is very developer-friendly and really hard to navigate if you're a citizen, and there's no way that a property owner or a citizen can have input into these large development processes. And so even if you have these great policies at a top level as your public policy, if you don't actually have the processes in place through law to really get the results that you want, it's never going to happen. And so that's what I think is like the most interesting thing. And I think what gets people so frustrated is because you can see people trying, but you don't understand all the things going on in the background that are stopping people from actually accomplishing the goals that you want.
And I guess as a citizen, how do you see people contacting people like lawyers or policymakers to have input? Do you see that happening now, or do you think that's something in a relationship that needs to build? And if it is, how can, you know, just average day people get involved in things like that?
So I'll speak to mostly the land use area and zoning, which is the part that I've become more specialized in, but a lot of this is really engaging at a local level because national politics, they're great and they're really important to keep involved with, and you can call your senator and that's all really important, but you can have a huge impact at a local level. There's this thing called the Board of Zoning Appeals, and then they approve all these developments, and then also you have the city or county council, and they're the ones who approve all of the developments going on in your county. The more you can do to get engaged at a local level, understand how the structure of your local government works, try to understand who is a decision maker and engage with them, you'll see a much, much, much greater impact than you would if you're trying to fight at a national level. Because if you have a county executive who has like 3,000 citizens or constituents who they never hear from, and then all of a sudden they're hearing like 50 people saying we don't want this development and we're the ones who are electing you, it's going to make a huge impact. That would be my suggestion. I mean, that goes with like grassroots activism as well. The more you can engage at a local level, the more impact you'll see in like the short term. What I've learned from the perspective of developers is that like developers are not inherently evil, right? Like there is development that is good, but not all development is good. And the more that citizens are engaged with the process, the more developers will realize they actually need to engage the community before they start proposing projects. Because you could have a situation where a developer comes to the community and is like, we are thinking this, is this something you're interested in before we get started? And then that would save everyone a lot of time down the road. But there's not good processes for that, and there's not a lot of interest as well. So
I was going to say, I feel like it's probably a mixture of low interest by constituents, right? But also, do you think that that process is made a bit complicated or not as intriguing intentionally?
So I think the problem is that people in charge of development, it's a pretty small circle, and they all come from similar backgrounds. And so you're in an echo chamber of development is new jobs, is better economy, when instead you could rely on perhaps like recreational development or recreational economies or hiking and or like small family-owned shops. All that is a lot harder to generate economy and tax bases from, but it's valuable and can strengthen your community. So it's really, yes, to answer your question in a shorter way, yes, the process is set up to help developers develop quickly, and it's not designed to have people be engaged.
So, you know, as someone ideally that would be going into work on this local level that we're talking about, what is it that intrigues you or motivates you in this line of work?
So what I love about a local level is you have to get to know other people. If you want to do it well, you have to figure out like what is your life actually like on a day-to-day basis, and then what is it that I can do to make that better. And that for me seems a lot more manageable and a lot more tangible in how you can help people, and you can really see the difference, which is good, because if you do it poorly, you can know that you're doing it poorly and adjust. Whereas if you're at a more national level, you could have some good ideas, but it has such a broad impact, it's hard to know like what you're doing well and if you're really accomplishing your goals. So that's what I love about the local levels.
You guys heard it here first. National politics is the golden rule. Local politics is the platinum rule, baby.
Oh, yeah. Let's end it right there.
Right? We're almost done here. What is something that everyone can do that can keep them well informed? I feel like you're like a very trustworthy person to share where you get your information from, especially like local news or even national.
I definitely try to pull from a lot of different sources. My main go-to is anything Crooked Media. So you got Pod Save America, What a Day. Pod Save the People is one of my favorites, especially if you want to talk about race and justice and some of the like not, I wouldn't say unpopular, but like not focused on aspects of the news. And they get into a lot more policy and like data behind stuff, which I think is really interesting, particularly around like police violence and education. I also try to follow influencer or like accounts on Instagram. The more things I have on Instagram that I'm following that aren't just people looking pretty, which is like great, good for you, like the more I feel happy. So I try to follow particularly women of color. I try to follow like accounts about like sexuality and gender identity. I try to follow political accounts where I can. I would just say also, like, don't be intimidated is the biggest thing. Like, a lot of these sound like they're really hard to understand, and I think a lot of people in politics would like to feel like they're really hard to understand, but if you have the confidence that you can think critically, they're really not that hard, especially once you just get into it a little bit. So that would be my biggest advice, is don't feel intimidated. Find a way to learn about it that's interesting to you. If you like reading, then read about it. If you like listening, then listen to it. But like, don't feel like it's a homework, like it's one of those like math assignments where you have no idea what you're doing. Just know that it's, most of it's relatively common sense. It's just figuring out how to address problems.
That's beautiful.
And I mean, that's really something I've learned in law school, is a lot of people who go into law don't know much about policy making, mm-hmm. and a lot of people who are in policy making don't know much about the law.
Yes.
So there's a big disconnect.
Okay, so Closing this out, do you have any articles, literature, or videos you'd like to plug?
When I thought about that, I'll plug like the ones I had to read for school, which I thought were fantastic. One would be The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein. It's about, this guy kind of breaks down all of the like structural racism built into our land use process, and really goes into why white people have so much more generational wealth than people of color, particularly black people. It was fascinating and really eye-opening, mm-hmm. and really demonstrates how intense and ingrained this issue is. Another one would be, I think it was called Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. I hope I pronounced his name right. And it's essentially like a letter to his son describing like his fears of him being a Black man in America. Also very eye-opening. I don't feel like, especially in academia, that we get access to the perspective of a Black person in America. We get a lot of white people explaining it to us. So
yeah,
I love the opportunity to really hear it from that perspective. And I think that's it. That's all we got.
All right.
Thank you so much for taking the time out to talk to us, Alex.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor talking to you guys and having the opportunity to share. So,
of course. You totally embody our message of just getting started. The idea that this stuff does not have to be intimidating is the whole reason why we started this podcast. So we love having friends like you on here and just helping part of the process.
Oh, thank you so much.
We'll let you go.
And with that, we just wanted to say thank you guys for returning and tuning in.
As we'd like to emphasize, we're just here to spark something for everyday people who do everyday things that have the magic to make differences everywhere.
With that being said, if you're feeling in the mood, leave us a review and follow us on Instagram if you don't already, @PlatinumRule Podcast.
Bye.